This edition of The Cinema Show was first broadcast on the 11th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. The Cinema Show in association with Mubi. Today's edition of The Cinema Show, we're taking off for the sublime shores of the Gulf of Naples as we shine a spotlight on some of cinema's most visually seductive masterpieces.
Lumapri is a wonderful, stunning film, and it's set really in two main locations, in Rome and on the island of Capri.
With a special focus on Jean-Luc Godard, we'll examine why this beautiful part of the world continues to inspire creative minds. Plus, we'll wander the labyrinthine lanes of Hong Kong that helped inspire Wong Kar-wai's classic In the Mood for Love.
I also suddenly discovered this love for the quirkiness of Hong Kong, for the light, for the back alleys, for the carts and things in the back.
And later in the show, Italian fashion designer Massimo Alba recalls the alluring appeal of his favourite island paradise hidden away off the coast of Naples.
Also, for drinking, his case really interesting because, the wine there is really good.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show, your guide to the world of film on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House for this very first edition of The Cinema Show with Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. I'm joined today by the author and researcher Richard Martin. Now, of course, as we mentioned, today's show is focusing on some of the most visually striking images in cinema. And Richard, I'm so pleased to have you here today because you are, of course, the author of the book, The Architecture of David Lynch. And you're also presenting a discussion at the British Film Institute here in London on the 13th of January, all about Jean-Luc Godard's use of architecture in his films. We'll get to those two directors a little later, but first, perhaps just start us off with some of your thoughts on the basic concept of how settings and scenery play into what we see and experience in the cinema.
Well, I think the sheer visual pleasure of cinema, the kind of shimmer of the screen and the glitzy Hollywood culture that surrounds it, I think this is something that has appealed and almost seduced audiences right since the birth of the medium. But it's something also that has its problematic side as well. I think we can feel that we're being seduced by a film into having certain emotions or experiences that we both like, but also might take us into dangerous territory as well.
So one of the reasons I wanted to look at the role of beautiful cinema this week is because, of course, By the Sea has just hit cinemas, the new film written and directed by Angelina Jolie. The film has received some, well, shall we say, mixed reviews, but there's no doubting the visuals here are nothing short of stunning. It's set in France in the mid-1970s, but was shot on location in Malta. And Angelina Jolie may indeed have received some of her inspiration from Le Mépris, Jean-Luc Godard's film from 1963 that's returning to cinema screens at the BFI in January. We'll get to that in more detail soon, but Richard, first, perhaps just take us back a little, though, because the concept of using extreme visual beauty to tell a story really owes quite a bit to the silent era.
Absolutely. As Norma Desmond says in Sunset Boulevard, we had faces then. And so the close-up in silent cinema is a particular way of showing the beauty of the actor and seducing the audience, I think, at the same time. I think the first film where I was immediately captivated by its visual beauty was David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, which is a film that both seduces you but also makes you aware of how it's manipulating you as well. So the first two-thirds or three-quarters of that film are showing you an image of Los Angeles and Hollywood that's extremely attractive, and it's full of, in a sense, cliches. So we have palm trees and Hollywood sign, and we have wonderful Art Deco apartments, and we also have modernist houses on the side of the Hollywood Hills. And there's a sense in which this all adds up to an extremely attractive, beautiful image of Los Angeles. And then there's, in the latter stages of the film, Lynch undercuts that and plays with your attachment to those particular beautiful images. And I think that was a film that was extremely important for me in showing how the visual beauty of cinema can also be a dangerous attraction as well.
So, in addition to simply looking beautiful, the settings and environment here also need to play a role in communicating what's happening on the screen, at least if they're to be effective. How do you think all of those elements relate to each other?
Well, I think for me, it's always important to stress that cinema is a spatial art, that what a director does is architectural, that an architect and a filmmaker, they're both involved in framing and sequencing space. And producing a beauty out of that is something that both architects and filmmakers are interested in. I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves. And I think when we really love a film, we tend to fall in love with the entire space that we're immersed in when we're watching it.
And of course, that really touches upon some of the themes in your book, which explores the rather interesting concept of a film director as an architect.
Yes, so I wrote a book that came out last year called The Architecture of David Lynch, and it's a book that offers the argument that Lynch's career should be thought of as a kind of architectural project, that we should think about the rooms and the houses and the cities and the roads that he films. We should think about how he relates to these spaces in the same way as we might think about how an architect goes about shaping space. And the project came about really through me watching these films and feeling that the most interesting and the most compelling thing about them was the spaces that we're placed in. And I wanted to take this as a starting point. What if we considered a filmmaker's career as an architectural project? What would be at stake in that question? What might it tell us about film, but what might it also tell us about architecture as well and about the kinds of spaces and places that we live ourselves?
What about films that are taking place somewhere that is simply ugly and horrible? Do you think filmmakers need to be careful there not to make those sorts of images too beautiful?
This is an interesting question. I think it can also change over time as well. So if I'm thinking about films set in New York in the 1970s, so Taxi Driver or The French Connection or Dog Day Afternoon, often they show this image of Manhattan in particular that looks like it's full of crime and it's kind of depressed economically and there's graffiti everywhere and the metro looks terrifying. But there's a strange way in which it looks extremely thrilling as well. And when you compare how Manhattan looks in those films with how Manhattan can often feel these days and can feel much more homogenous or corporate, then suddenly films like Taxi Driver look like a much more thrilling or attractive vision of urban life. So I think these very images, they can act as a historical record of a place. They capture a place at a certain moment in time. And then how we relate to that can change as the decades go past.
We'll hear more from Richard Martin soon. But first, I'd like to turn our attention to another visually stunning film that makes great use of urban architecture in creating its alluring sense of romance. In the Mood for Love is director Wong Kar-wai's much-praised film from 2000, which has undoubtedly become a modern classic. And the film certainly owes much of its visual splendour to Hong Kong's labyrinthine network of alleys. The photographer Michael Wolfe was inspired by the seductive allure of Hong Kong. His work capturing the city in a series of photographs is the subject of a new exhibition here in London. He paid a visit to us here at Midori House for a chat with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
I realized quite quickly that Hong Kong has this huge network of back alleys where the workmen, the cleaning ladies, the construction workers put their things after they finish work. And they're wonderful arrangements of mops and gloves and carts and old umbrellas. And I've been photographing them for the past 12 years or so. And this show is the first time where they will really be shown in a larger scale.
Let's talk about, there's this beautiful, very interesting picture as well about pink gloves in some wires and outside the city. Can you tell us a bit about that, about this picture in particular? Mm-hmm.
Well, almost every work person in Hong Kong wears gloves. And because Hong Kong is a Confucianist society, there's no vandalism or very little vandalism or, theft. So in the evenings, people will just take their work clothes and their gloves and they will wash them and hang them up to dry. And if you walk through the back alleys early in the morning, you can see these like Alexander Calder's almost, gloves hanging from coat hangers and drying. And then the next morning when they start work, they put on their gloves again and go about their way. And the same cycle repeats every afternoon or evening.
Talking about repetition, I heard that you always come back to the place where you took the picture, like sometimes 20 times. Is that true? Why do you do that?
Well, the back alleys are for me an organic living being almost. They're constantly changing. So an arrangement which I find interesting with two mops, if I go there a week later, it might consist of three or four mops, or there might be some glove hanging from the mop. So it's always changing. And the more often I go there, the more variety I can photograph. I like doing series where you can see a progression or you can see the change. In a way, it's an expression of creativity, how all these things are assembled and hung out to dry.
The way you portray the back alleys of Hong Kong, I can even make a parallel. I was talking to our producer Ben Ryland with the film In the Mood for Love, mm-hmm. by Wong Kar-wai. And have you seen the film?
Did you
see some similarities as well? Because, I mean, the landscape of Hong Kong is very essential for that film.
It's a very interesting question, which I thought about a lot, because one of the first films I saw was Chungking Express, which is also an early Wong Kar-wai film. And it also plays in the back alleys of Kowloon, partially. And what's interesting is that the cameraman, Chris Doyle, is actually the person who is behind the visuals and who saw Hong Kong in his particular way. And in a way, it influenced me as well. And I also suddenly discovered this love for the quirkiness of Hong Kong, for the light, for the back alleys, for the carts and things in the back. So I think both of us have really influenced how foreigners see the city.
Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco there in conversation with the photographer Michael Wolfe. The Informal Arrangements exhibition runs until the 9th of January at Flowers Gallery here in London. And Michael's work is also the subject of a new book, Informal Solutions, Observations in Hong Kong Back Alleys, published by WE Press. Still to come on The Cinema Show, we'll chat to director Guy Maddin about his striking sense for visual surprises. Stay tuned.
The Arctic is one of the more inhospitable places on Earth, but as Monocle's film crew discovered, there's a trove of stories to be told by the local media about the vast and varied Canadian Arctic.
You start looking at residential school relocation, you start looking at missing and murdered Indigenous women, you start looking at food security and the incredibly high suicide rate here in Nunavut. If we wanted to, as a network, just stick to those stories, we could be the saddest show on Canadian television. You have to balance some of that out with some uplifting stories to show people struggling against those conditions, but winning.
Reporting the Arctic, now showing, along with over 500 more Monocle films and slideshows on monocle.com.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, presented with Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning cinema. Now it gives me great pleasure to welcome one of the most original voices in cinema today. Guy Maddin is the man behind films such as 2003's The Saddest Music in the World, the monochromatic obscurity that featured, among many other things, Isabella Rossellini sporting a set of glass legs filled with beer. He also crafted the ultimate pet project with 2007's My Winnipeg, a bizarre journey through his own dreamlike recollections of youth in the eternally wintry Canadian city. Now, that film also saw him resurrect the career of an almost forgotten film legend, Anne Savage. Joining me from Boston, Massachusetts, Guy Maddin, welcome to The Cinema Show. Now, I was just reacquainting myself, Guy, with your latest film, The Forbidden Room. Now, I think it's fair to say that you pack more visual curiosities in there than many directors manage, probably in their entire career. Can you take us back a little bit to some of those strange little obscurities that have influenced you over all that time?
Yeah, my co-director, Evan Johnson, and I set out to make a movie that the likes of which had never been seen before, we hoped. But we were, in fact, inspired by some things we'd seen before. There's a short film on YouTube I recommend looking at by Bill Morrison called Light is Calling. Just a few minutes long, 7 minutes long or something like that. I think Bill found some film that was just on death's doorstep, just the moment before it was about to totally collapse into a kind of a pile of dust, mildew, and vinegary goo, and digitally rephotographed it one frame at a time. There's no way that film could have gone through a projector without, you know, just gumming it all up. But it just looked so beautiful, the way these mildews and degraded chemicals effloresced while in motion. They really reminded me of, you know, since the film was on the film, which is a ghostly haunted medium in the first place, was already, this particular stretch of film, whatever it was getting ready to pass over to the filmic afterlife. The blobbiness of it all and the darkness and the strangeness of it really reminded me of what film's ectoplasm would be like. You know, humans, if you're a spiritualist, you believe that humans have some sort of ectoplasmic gloop emanating out of each and every one of us while we're communicating with the other side. Well, it seemed to me that film itself is ectoplasmic, and just this stuff in motion, you know, ghosts locked in emulsion while falling to pieces, seem to be the very substance of spiritualism.
You've also worked on a pet project at Paris's Pompidou Centre, which aimed to revive one lost or forgotten film every day. And you took on your own revival project a few years ago when you resurrected the film career of one of film noir's long-lost and overlooked legends, Anne Savage, whom I just love. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, Anne Savage, perhaps the most ferocious femme fatale in film noir history, the star of Edgar Ulmer's Poverty Row classic, Detour. She just struck me as the kind of woman, great name, Anne Savage. She is just so ferocious, and she struck me as someone that would even make Betty Davis hide behind a potted palm at a movie premiere, you know. And I remember when I finished writing my treatment for My Winnipeg, I was commissioned to make, by the documentary channel back home in Canada, to make a documentary about my hometown, but I realized if I didn't want to make a regular documentary. I wanted to make, I don't know, a documentary about my hometown. And my mother was a very ferocious presence herself, and it occurred to me the only person who could play my mother was Anne Savage, and I lamented the fact that Anne Savage wasn't around to play my mom. I assumed she was dead, and I lamented in an email to Dennis Bartok, who was the film programmer at the Egyptian Theater in L.A., that I needed Anne Savage. Too bad I couldn't get her. But he said he just had dinner with her and had her phone number. And so he put me in touch with her, and next thing I knew, I got her. I had talked her into coming out of retirement. She hadn't really acted regularly since 1955. And so bringing her back, I realized I was born basically 9 months after she retired. I could have easily just said that Anne retired from film to have me, that she was my mother, and she basically was by the time I finished lying so much while making that movie.
Such an amazing and unlikely story. Guy Madden, thank you very much for chatting to us today on The Cinema Show. The Forbidden Room is out in selected theatres today. My Winnipeg is currently showing on Mubi for UK audiences, and if you haven't seen Anne Savage in Detour, I strongly encourage you to go and have a look. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with Mubi. Richard Martin is still with me here in the studio. Richard, let's turn our attention now to Jean-Luc Godard, who is, of course, the subject of your upcoming discussion at the BFI here in London. I've got a still here from Alphaville, Godard's 1965 dystopian future world, taking place in a faraway corner of the galaxy. Now, it's an image of the actress Anna Karina descending a rather mid-century modern-looking spiral staircase. Richard, perhaps explain to us your thoughts on the role of architecture and scenery in Alphaville as you take a look at this image.
Well, it's funny because the first thing that, this makes me think of is where I was when I saw Alphaville for the first time, which was in the auditorium at Tate Modern, the Star Auditorium, which is a bright red auditorium. And in a strange way, it felt very futuristic, the setting that I was watching this film in. And I think that's a reminder that you're always involved in this kind of strange relationship when you're watching a film between what you're seeing on screen and where you're sat at the present time. In terms of this specific screenshot and Alphaville more generally, I think what's really interesting about what Godard does in that film is it's made in 1964. It gives you this dystopian view of the future. And yet Godard doesn't make any sets for this film. He entirely uses, in a sense, found architecture. He uses the suburbs of Paris, new housing developments that were going up at that time. So there's a way in which he's making the future out of what already exists in Paris in 1964. And again, actually, continuing what we've just been talking about, there's a combination of dystopian, fearful architecture, but also an incredible beauty to it as well, that it's stark, this kind of monochrome imagery, which I think particularly in stills can seem extremely appealing as well. And I think that's often something that goes on with dystopian films more generally. There's a sense in which we're really enjoying a kind of architecture, a kind of scenery that actually also has perhaps more authoritarian connotations.
Why do you think Godard chose to use only, as you put it, found architecture?
Well, I think on the practical side, this is about budgets as well, and that it's a lot cheaper to use the buildings and the spaces that already exist rather than building them in a studio. But for Godard, that's also a matter of cinematic truth or representation as well, so that instead of decamping with an enormous crew to a studio on the outskirts of a city, that you film in the very spaces of the city itself, and you can get to something else by doing that. I also think there's a point that he's making in that when we're thinking about dystopian films, there's often a way in which we can separate that from the conditions of the present day. And Godard's actually drawing links between the present and the future by using the spaces that are going up all around Paris at that time.
Well, let's look at another Jean-Luc Godard film now, Le Mépris. Many point to this as the pinnacle of beautiful filmmaking. I mean, you've got Brigitte Bardot, some iconic Italian film locations at Cinecittà Studios, blended with real scenery, and of course, the eternally shimmering waters of the Gulf of Naples. Richard, perhaps introduce us to what's going on in the film.
Le Mépris is a wonderful, stunning film, and it's set really in two main locations, in Rome and on the island of Capri. And it makes use of both real locations, as you suggest, with the apartments in Rome, where the central couple, played by Brigitte Bardot and Michel Piccoli, have a 20-minute long domestic argument where they're walking in and out of doors and rooms. And it takes us from there to an incredible house on the cliffside on Capri, the Villa Malaparte. And I think there's so much going on in Le Mépris. You can see it as a film that's about the relationship between Europe and America, and that there's a very brash and crude American producer who seems to be attempting to kind of commercialize European cinema. You can see it as a film that's about translation and adaptation, in that it contains a film within itself as well. There's a film being made in Le Mépris, which is being directed by Fritz Lang. And it's a film about a particular kind of relationship and how that relationship might change and relate to the spaces in which it's being played out.
As you say, there is a lot happening here, visually and thematically. We even have the legendary film director Fritz Lang playing himself. What relationship do you think the images and extreme beauty have with the story here?
I think one of the connections that Le Mépris makes is it makes a connection between a love affair between a man and a woman and a third party, a kind of love triangle, with the love of the movies, with cinephilia. So there's a way in which that film is in love with the history of cinema, but also sees the history of cinema in a way that's falling to pieces in some way. The studio system is falling to pieces. The shots at Cinecittà are full of walls with peeling paint and posters that are falling down. So there's a way in which the film industry is breaking down as the relationship between Michel Piccoli and Brigitte Bardot is also breaking down. So Godard seems to align the relationship between two people with the relationship with cinema as well.
Well, as we've mentioned, much of the action in Le Mépris takes place on the island of Capri in the Gulf of Naples. Now, I was lucky enough to visit the Gulf some weeks ago, including one of the other islands there, Ischia. It's slightly less clogged with tourists than the better-known Capri, making it a popular stand-in when filmmakers are looking to capture that sense of Italian postcard glamour. Le Plein Soleil, the original French adaptation of the Patricia Highsmith novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley, made great use of the island's picturesque settings in 1960, as did its 1999 remake. So what is it about this part of the world that is so alluring? Well, we posed that question to one of Ischia's most notable residents, Italian fashion designer Massimo Alba.
Ischia is an island seated on a volcano, so you can feel it. You can feel it starting from the hot water, from the thermal spring. And every day I used to spend 1 or 2 hours relaxing myself in the hot water. But what makes really special Ischia is the food. The food of Ischia is really something that you have to try. One of my favorite restaurants is the Trattoria Ischitana, which is located at the Parco Termale Negombo. It's a very good friend of mine, the name is Giacchino, and you can taste a very, very simple but very special food. Spaghetti al pomodoro, for instance, or mozzarella and pomodoro. The traditional, simple food from the country of Ischia. And also for drinking, Ischia is really interesting because, you know, the wine there is really good because really few people know that Ischia started producing wine 2,000 years ago. The Roman people used to cultivate very special viti. So there is a long and deep tradition on wine. And so you can eat a very good fish, drink really good white wine. We spend all our holidays basically in the garden, working in a garden, and or by the sea because we have a boat and we like to spend our time floating all around the island. The fishermen used to call us if they have something special, and we go there and we take the fish, and then we decided to cook it in the home or in the boat. And so we always spend time really close to something very simple, really, really simple. So, for instance, we have a little orchard in the garden, and it's nice to cook when you are just, you know, floating and relaxing, and, you know, everything is very, very simple, but very, very tasteful.
Massimo Alba there recalling the many reasons for his love of the Italian island of Ischia. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. A very special thank you to all of my guests today, Guy Madden, Michael Wolfe, Massimo Alba, and of course, Richard Martin. The Jean-Luc Godard season runs at the British Film Institute here in London from the 1st of January until the 16th of March 2016. And Le Mépris will also screen in selected cinemas across the UK. If you'd like to hear more from Richard, he's holding a special discussion on Jean-Luc Godard as an architect on the 13th of January. You can listen to this show again and find out more at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And you can always get in touch by sending me an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show with Mubi is back next week. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.